Greetings and salutations, everybody. Thank you for joining me once more. We're back rolling with the Lumieres podcast. My name is Jody White. Thank you for coming on board this good ship. Today, I'm coming to you, not live, from a converted library bus in the wilds of West Herefordshire, where we're in the process of has been quite a long drawn-out move to the westerly lands of the UK. While we're in that process, we're staying in this beautiful old library bus on a friend's place and just enjoying the change of pace here and the real sense of slowing down. And it's the autumn equinox yesterday, a new moon. Feels like a time of changing seasons, marking the progression into autumn once more. The sun starts dipping down a little lower in the sky and the days become a little shorter and we get to slow down and think about coziness, think about woolen jumpers and fires. And at least if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, as I always try and point out, not everyone's feeling this, but this is where I am. And so this is what I'm going to talk to you about today. And we're here, we've got limited phone signal. We're just popping into our friend's place to use the Wi-Fi. It's refreshingly different from our kind of hyper-connected world in the Southeast where we were previously in. And it feels healthy, you know, to take a step back. Using the word healthy, I've been suffering with a cold for the last 4 days. You can probably tell my voice is a little bit strained, but hopefully that's not going to put your ears off too much. And we'll roll along and get into today's episode. Today I've got a great chat for you with the extraordinarily gifted painter, sculptor. He lends his hands to many things, as you'll hear. And his name is Luke Brown, and he's a Canadian artist. He's been very prominent in the kind of visionary art, so-called, scene. And his works are incredibly detailed, incredibly vibrant, and are mainly drawn from his experiences in lucid dreaming and psychedelic journey states, where he has the ability to retain a sort of observer consciousness in these states and sort of commit to memory in a way some of the visionary states that he finds himself in and the sort of dimensional realms that he finds himself in and how they manifest in visual form. So he has the ability to sort of get to these places, go deep into these states, and then take snapshots, if you like, of his imagination. And he can then turn these snapshots into physical form for us to appreciate in the form of his paintings and his other creative works. But he's primarily known as a painter. And this was a kind of accident, really, this podcast, because I was going around to my friend Sophia's house to do a podcast with her. And I will get her on it at some point, Sophia, if you're listening. But Luke was staying there as he's a friend of hers and of her partner Carl's, and it just felt fortuitous. So we had a little chat. I was up for it and he was up for it. So we decided to sit down on a sunny day in Sussex and just have a little freestyle podcast. And Luke was kind enough to share his journey with me and with you. And he talks about his early days growing up in Canada and going through the art system in schools and how one of his first kind of breakthrough psychedelic experiences really changed his life and changed the direction of his life, really, and gave him a mission, gave him a purpose, gave him a vision that he was brave enough to listen and follow. And if you see where it's got him today, you know, there's no question there was something in that. It's quite clear the man is incredibly talented and he's a lovely guy too. And he possesses these rare abilities to enter these mystical states or to get into such trance-like states through various mediums and transcribe what he sees in his art for us. He's kind of like an emissary, an explorer. You know, he calls himself sometimes an explorer, sent off into these worlds to discover what's there, really, and then bring it back to show everybody else. And it was a rare chance to chat with Luke face-to-face, I guess. He usually resides in Bali, and kind of he travels around quite a lot, but he's not in the UK a whole lot. So it just felt like a great chance to sit down and talk with someone who is incredibly talented, and he's most definitely a fit for the Lumieres podcast. So I do hope you enjoy this chat with Luke, and do let me know what you think. If you want to keep in touch with everything I'm doing, Instagram Life in Fractals, Facebook Life in Fractals, LumieresPodcast.com, could you come and say hi? All the links to Luke's work will be up on the website. Thanks again to Luke for being up for this conversation, and I do hope you enjoy it. Next time we have a chat with Carl Smith, who is a man on a mission to redefine the human experience in terms of technology. A fascinating guy and a real gentleman, so I'm looking forward to sharing that with you, and have plenty of other goodies coming up over the next few weeks and months. I'll play you in, as ever, with a little tune. I was listening to some of Simon Posford's work, who you may know as one half of Spongel. I love that word. He did some other work with Benji Vaughan and under the Younger Brother name, and there's some great, they did some sort of more straight ahead pop songs informed by their sort of electronic wizardry, and there's some great tunes on their records. So I would say go and check some of their stuff out, and this track comes from their first record, which is called A Flock of Bleeps, and it's called Bedtime Story.
Canada.
Yeah. Whereabouts in Canada?
London, Ontario.
Okay, yeah. I've actually been there, weirdly enough.
Yeah. It's like a miniature version of London, England. It's like the mini golf course kind of
there's not a whole lot
amusement
there,
park version
remember.
Of London.
It's just England. Outside Toronto, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got all the same street names and park names, and it's on the Thames River, and it's Covent Garden Market,
it's
and
on the
Portobello
Thames River.
Road, and all of the same, just miniaturized. It was a really good place to grow up, because it was close enough to have all of the progressive culture and music and everything without this crack in the crime rate.
Okay.
It was like a little, you know, a safe little satellite node of Toronto.
Mm. So is that when you kind of, when did your kind of interest in art and drawing and painting, and did that develop as a kid, or was that later on?
Yeah, I mean, it was creativity and expression was always supported and encouraged, and I grew up in a really unconventional situation with artist, musician parents. My father's a fairly well-known musician, and and his band was really big on the folk music scene, and were, you know, headlining acts at the folk festivals, and so I grew up just surrounded by musicians, and he was the director of a folk festival in Ontario, and so we'd have all these big names rolling through, and you know, the Gypsy Kings jamming, drinking whiskey in my living room, playing music until sunrise. And my mother's a accomplished artist too, and she's got books out on her work. She's a photographer, and she's got a permanent exhibit in the National Gallery of Canada. And
formative influences.
They weren't like pushing me to be a lawyer or something.
No,
they're just like,
no.
You know, whatever you want to do, you know, they supported me. And I didn't really consider myself to be an artist, or that was where my life was headed. When I was in high school, I was really into, I was into theater. I was into skateboarding. I was one of, you know, like a lead role in the high school plays. And but yeah, it wasn't until one fateful night with my brother and his friends, who had known me since I was born and had this psychedelic upheaval.
Yeah. So you had a kind of
a significant heroic dose meltdown experience. Well, it was maybe meltdown's a bit of a stretch. It was very manageable, but it was a phenomenal revelation of, you know, my life up until that point, of being made very clear to me that this is what is in store for me, and that I have a talent that should be applied, and that I can dedicate myself to that, and everything will fall into place, basically. Was the feeling that emerged that night.
Sounds quite clear. I get the feeling. Yeah.
Yeah, which is rare for a teenager to have his his destiny spelled out so clearly with confidence.
Yeah.
And
did you believe it, or did you kind of, was it like it was so clear that you just had no choices to be like, okay, I accept it?
Well, I had a blank sketchbook that I just started filling up page after page throughout the night, and being astonished by what was coming out. You know, like a skill level that I can look back and feel like it's comparative to
from the, you know, as
I mean,
a kind
I did
raw...
I did drawings and doodles in my math books in school, but I never really committed to making a piece of art or thinking like, you know, I'm an artist, I make art. You know, I would just do doodles here and there. But yeah, it was definitely an access to a coherent creative channel that had a very distinct aesthetic to it that had my mind just reeling in all possible directions with all possible mediums, and feeling like that aesthetic can be applied in all these forms, and then it's uniquely mine. Mm. I was seeing in my inner vision, you know, architecture and, you know, everything from like stained glass windows to bronze cast door handles to arranged garden forms to clothing design to tattoos to paintings and sculptures, and just any creative thought I had, I could see it applied into forms and mediums. And
as a result of the experience, you mean, it kind of changed the way that
it just like unlocked some latent, you know,
your imagination was kind of
intensity
changed.
Yeah. It was a squeegeeing of my third eye to crystal clarity. So yeah, and it really opened up a deep reverence and appreciation and enthusiasm for the psychedelic experience, because it was, I mean, I'm really visually oriented, and my experience of just inner visualization can be really clear and sustained, and, you know, have a really vivid multi-sensory, multi-level dream life. Mm-hmm. Like my dreams at night are just so intricate and multi-sensory. And a lot of the times I can retain it. So yeah, just having that kind of over-amplified visual orientation and kind of spatial awareness. Mm. Just introducing the hallucinogenic experience to that kind of already kind of
just kind of brought it out
aspect of myself. Yeah, I just cranked the dial to volume 11, and yeah, I started to do all kinds of work that for me was kind of trying to capture or encapsulate or portray the essence of what that psychedelic experience was and what the quality of kind of the hallucinatory template looks like. Trying to portray it with as much accuracy as I can, like trying to commit to portraying it accurately. I had this distinct experience with LSD and in particular, where I could have a really vivid inner vision, but I could also sustain it in a way where I could observe it or kind of dissect the visual phenomena and what it's comprised of, or how to kind of not just get lost in the eye candy but actually really take note of what's going on in there and
so commit kind of the forms to some of the forms to memory, almost like taking snapshots.
I would kind of dissect it analytically, but like visually analytically, not like philosophically.
Sure,
or
right.
You know, it was like I could find a way to kind of break it down to stages to arrive at a certain effect, like a visual effect that seemed to be a kind of recurring effect. And so I started to...
That sounds quite specialized, like the way you've developed that almost, because it's so easy in these experiences, which can often be quite overwhelming at first, and, you know, for you to be able to stabilize in that space and be able to take notes and analyze.
I feel really grateful for that, because I think it can be a really overwhelming thing for a lot of people, and it can be... most people lack the linguistic terminology to apply to the experience or even any kind of skill to express it. And so it ends up kind of being left to solely to the ingestion of a substance, and that's it.
Yeah.
And then it's left as a kind of intangible memory. And I've had incredible experiences, like really phenomenally incredible experiences with displaying my work in let's say overtly psychedelic environments, you know, places where that experience is familiar. Burning Man, for instance, where you're preaching to the converted in a way, you know, but it's been really helpful for me to be able to convey this expression to that kind of audience that can really grok it and receive
it
and reflect it back. And it feels like there's something that's been reiterated a lot over many years and many experiences where there's some kind of, I'm just like on duty to portray this kind of indescribable dimension or indescribable to most people.
Mm.
And a lot of reflection I've received is a kind of reassurance or comfort from people that the experience they had was something that was significant and real. And
that's an interesting aspect of it, because you're kind of like, you're almost documenting something which is impossible to document.
Yeah.
And then, like you say, that's providing such a valuable reflection for people who aren't able to do that.
Yeah.
And even to kind of to help explain or to help describe the experience to people who've never done it before, it's like a little window into this world.
Yeah. And I'm really grateful that, you know, the work that I've been able to create and the skills that I've been able to cultivate and develop have refined that feeling of, you know, the conveying of the accuracy has just been, you know, refined and refined over the years. Mm. And I mean, to me, I look at my work and it's not just, it doesn't just allude to it or kind of, you know, describe it or lean in the direction of it. Like, to me, that's it. That's as it can be.
And but that's what you're, I mean, that sounds like you've got such a singular vision there. It's like you're not gonna, the piece isn't complete until it fits your, what you consider to be that vision, right?
Yeah. I mean, I went to art school. I went to two schools. The first one was in London, Ontario, and it was called Beale Art, and it was such an incredibly fortunate experience I had there, because it was...
What age were you?
It was high school years.
Yeah, like 16, 17.
Yeah, and that was when I had this initial awakening experience that I knew had to be channeled into making art, and I started to really explore the psychedelic experience intentionally with, you know, a creative application and making artwork with that experience and just having these phenomenal, like being in a kind of witness state where there's a process that's unfolding that doesn't have, you know, a conscious decision-making process as a part of it. It's just underway, and I'm watching it unfold in front of me. In my,
such a powerful
but my body is creating it. Like my hand is moving on a page, and something is coming through. But I'm not accessing a kind of lucid, you know, decision-making process. It's just happening.
Channeled,
I consider that to be channeling.
Yeah,
that's
completely.
Just accessing the current of universal creativity that's informing all observable phenomena and just keeping the novelty wave peaking.
There's something
continuously
really
there's like a that's that current is what is informing the field in which we're embedded. And so just being in the kind of just energetic conditions to allow for that state to be phenomenal things happen. Like just some of the most masterful artworks and music have come from that place of just just accessing that state. And so I realized that it's really of utmost importance to me to cultivate those conditions in my life, not just when I'm making art, but as a lifestyle.
Yeah, interesting.
And
there's something interesting, I think, about that age as well, when you're sort of pubescent, not quite fully what we'd say adult, you know. It's such a kind of in-between magical stage where you're really open to exploring yourself and your own gifts in the world, and it feels like that's a real key point to have it's like 16 is often the age of initiation experiences in some cultures. That there's something around that sort of age where it's like on the cusp of adulthood.
Yeah.
And if you can get in there and like unlock yourself a little bit around that age, I think
I mean, it was so clear to me at that time that this is what's in store for me.
Yeah.
And you know, there was, you know, my other school studies pretty much slipped off the map. I was like, why algebra? What am I going to use that for?
Yeah.
It was just like minimal effort applied to my other studies, because it was like, so the school that I went to, Beale was a really incredibly fortunate circumstance to be gifted at that age when all this was transpiring for me, because it was a high school, but it had a college level art program.
Unusual for Canada?
Yeah. I don't even know if it's really still operational with the kind of budget cuts they've had in the schools and stuff, but this was a really amazing thing. And it was like two blocks from my house. So I switched high schools from, you know, the kind of middle to upper class, you know, privileged white, predominantly white school to the other school in the other direction on the other side of the tracks that was like, you know, had a bit of a rougher edge to it, and you know, had like the automotive department and, you know, the like low income neighborhood. So it was like a totally different world to be in, which is really, I mean, I fit in way better there. But it was amazing because I got to have my courses in high school, like from morning to noon was like, you know, English and geography and science and, you know, all the high school basics. But then from lunchtime until whenever, I was doing everything from filmmaking to ceramics to jewelry to figure drawing, illustration, painting, everything.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like quite a rare experience to have at that age.
Totally.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, and to be able to just have that healthy channel for everything that was erupting within me in a totally supportive, you know, high school experience and totally supportive family that were just totally on board with that. Yeah, and then from there I went to Ontario College of Art in Toronto, which is one of the biggest art schools in Canada.
Well, how did that differ from, did you feel like there was kind of, I guess there's different teachers and stuff like that, but did you have more of a focus at that point? Were you kind of honing in on, right, I'm going to start?
Not so much. I mean, I got advanced standing, which was really amazing. I got to skip the first year and just go straight into specializing, but then specializing for me was just wanting to get into every possible medium.
Okay.
And so even then I didn't really specialize. I was all over the school just getting into every medium that was in the building, which was problematic in my graduating years because after my first 2 years there, they eliminated what's called the interdisciplinary studies, which is what I was doing because they want everybody to just have a specialty. And I didn't, and so they extended my year. So I had to take all these other random courses to just get my credits.
Yeah.
Not that any of that has any relevance to me now. Like, have I ever shown anyone this piece of paper that I got from that? I mean, the whole time I was there, I felt like I was just paying expensive rent because most of the tuition or the teachers were just observe what I was doing and be like, great. Looks good. Like, how much are you getting paid to tell me that?
So did you feel like it was kind of, I guess it was helpful for your development to be in that scenario with all the resources available, but...
Yeah, the resources available for sure, but the environment I did not relate to, or the other students anyway. I mean, I was such a, you know, just interdimensional psychedelic maverick in there. And most of what was going on in there was just like the strangest, just nihilistic, you know, students drowning in their own self-importance for just concepts that had no meaning or relevance to my life. So I mean, in that place I felt like a bit of an alien and
So you just going back to what you're talking about, the way your work gets informed by these substances. Do you feel like there's a difference? Like if you're taking mushrooms, does the quality of the visual?
Yeah, for sure. That was something that I really took note of. You know, that they have different kinds of personalities and. Yeah, but I found, you know, the plant medicines like psilocybin and. Extracted DMT from plant material and ayahuasca, peyote, all those, they tend to have a kind of sentience to them.
Yeah.
Like it's a kind of, there's an intelligence in there, especially at, you know, really high threshold dosages. It makes itself very apparent how sentient it is and that there's an interactivity with the vision for me, like there's like a dialogue going on between
communication
between myself and whatever this substance is. And I mean, it's some really staggering degrees of interactivity. But the dialogue that I would have with those substances was not audible or linguistic. It was not like I'm formulating a sentence and a question and I'm asking it and it's responding to me in words.
Okay.
It was like a visual dialogue that would be exchanged back and forth where like vision, it would be visions were being reciprocated.
Speaking through images. And
yeah, like thought forms of, that I would have, it would kind of respond to me in another vision. And it was really, I mean, an exceptional experience. And I had some really powerful experiences in particular that I feel really changed the course of my art with that kind of sentient visual dialogue. I had this really powerful vision that I received at a time that was really really, really dark place in my life, when the course of my life was just unfolding relatively gracefully with, you know, having a life supported by creative endeavors and have abundance generated from that and experience that would, you know, I would be brought around the world. I would be flown to events and festivals and everything was orbiting around my artwork. I started to get some repetitive stress in my hands and forearm, and it was compromising my ability to make art. And
wow.
And that was a really kind of existential despair I fell into, because it was like, what am I without this? What other way do I know other than to express myself through these mediums? And yeah, it was really a hard place to accept or to sit with. And yeah, I had this experience with a huge dose of mushrooms with Syrian rue, which is an MAO inhibitor that stops the breakdown
in there. Up a little bit.
Yeah, just ramps it up way more and sustains it longer. And yeah, it's just a much more intense experience. But
so you
I felt
this
like I needed
way
to go there to really get deep into the root of myself and excavate whatever part of me was manifesting this ailment, because I didn't feel like I'm a victim of this, or that you know, I lost the cosmic lottery and it just, I'm tough luck, pal. You know, I felt like there was an aspect of myself that needed to be seen and uprooted and reconciled, that was manifesting as an injury, that was sabotaging my own success in a way. And that's exactly what I saw in there, was that that's what it was. It was like, you know,
How did it help you to
transpersonal observation of a kind of, like a self-sabotaging program that I don't really believe is my own or comes from my conditioning. It's part of the collective field of humanity that stands in its own way or doesn't believe that it's worthy of being its wholehearted, you know, successful, fully embodied, radiant self. You know, and we've manifested so many forms in the world that keep that perpetuated in the world. You know, we place all these powers outside of ourselves to external authorities to keep us in a tiny framework of our full infinite multidimensional selves.
Possible.
You know, and I saw this in my body. Like, I saw this kind of restriction based on this languaging in the subconscious mind, and it was like, yeah, it was kind of restricting my physical body, and I found a way to apply a kind of visually administered healing from the inside through acceptance and unconditional love for whatever this version of humanity is, and just allow it to let go. By feeling it letting go, and it allowed me to release this pain in my body. And but I saw this form and this figure in there that, I mean, I could say it's a kind of, you know, some kind of angelic guide, you could say. It was some kind of distinct interdimensional intelligence that was assisting the process and showing me what I needed to do. And for that, I'm truly grateful to have had access to that and be assisted by that kind of energy. And so when I was on the other side of this journey and just feeling so much love and gratitude for the opportunity to see this through and to be shown this and what it takes to move through these kinds of things. And so this figure that I was encountering in this inner space, I was asking, how can I convey this? What can I do to
honor the experience,
to honor it, you know, with reverence and so it started to break itself apart and show me in stages all the ways to construct not just its form but the environment that it's in. Mm-hmm. And it was showing me all these really specific forms, like sketchbooks from 1993 and paintings I did in college.
Wow.
And all this stuff was just kind of collaging the form together. Huh. And so, but it was showing me so specifically and with all this familiar stuff that I could, and I was so excited about this process that was being shown to me that I was able to retain the memory of what I need to do to respectfully show what this form is. And so I started to go through all my archives of stuff, and this was back in the days I would go to Kinko's photocopying places and photocopy paintings in two directions, like mirror images, and then I would take Fisker scissors or X-Acto blades and with surgical precision cut around the edge of every little serrated, you know, fractal fibrillation contour, and then use a little Sharpie marker to cover the edge of the paper so that there was no white. And then I started to tape these things together and glue them all together on this big table while this vision was fresh. And I was really trying to maintain the vision of this being. And within that week, a friend had come up. This is when I was living on the west coast of Canada, and a friend had moved up from San Francisco around Y2K time, and he was all freaked out about the States, and he's like, I just want to live in the woods with, no electricity, no running water. I'm leaving the city.
Yeah.
I'm just, like, backing out. And he's like, I have a flatbed scanner. I have all the latest Photoshop and Wacom tablet pen tools and all this technology. He was like, can I leave this with you? Would this be of any use to you? I was like, absolutely. That has a direct application to this moment and to my life forever. And so
this is like the digital revolution for you.
Yeah, this is where it kicked off an entirely new direction for me. I mean, it saved my life, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got to heal this repetitive stress, carpal tunnel like syndrome in my arm.
Did that
by using a medium that was had minimal impact on me.
Okay.
And the phenomenal thing about the way Photoshop is kind of mapped out is so synonymous with this kind of inner vision, like the sequence of visual effects that arrive at a certain thing.
Huh.
The way that my mind kind of constructs that internally, Photoshop is kind of mapped out that way, and so it
what
was
you
just
mean in
like
terms of like the layers and the way.
Well, it's just like all the tools and filters and everything, and the way it's all kind of mapped out. I could see it so clearly once I got familiar with all those tools.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
like, oh, if I take this and this and this and add that, and then put a Gaussian blur around the periphery at 10%, it does this. Okay, cool. All right, let's go for it. You know, I would be able to kind of
see how that would how you'd then create that in the digital
it's
space.
Almost autistic. It's like a kind of this Rain Man kind of approach. And and then that granted me this opportunity to accelerate my creative kind of output, because I could take a lot more risks in a shorter time to develop ideas that if I didn't have the digital tools, it might take me a lot longer, require much more patience and much more risk taking in work that may or may not be successful, that would end up having to like scrap a lot more resources.
Yeah. It's like
and it might be more discouraging in a way, whereas like with the digital format, it was like my learning curve was so quick and so steep then once I got to, you know, the first plateau with that, I want to hit another learning curve and just like keep exponentiating the potential. And yeah, it's
so did your kind really of phenomenal. Your form from
and,
there
and from
mixed?
That it allowed me to be embraced by a whole other kind of I started to be invited to much bigger events and kind of put into a higher profile with you know, appreciation from the psychedelic community, and been invited to, you know, Albert Hoffman's party in Switzerland or like, you know, these like really wild, you know, networking events that just like thrust me into this whole other kind of appreciation for my work from a demographic that really gets it, really receives it, and it also elevated me to a higher bracket of, you know, financial support for it too, which gets channeled back into, you know, creative projects. And yeah, it's been a really phenomenal journey that way.
It sounds like it. You're living out in Bali, are you still at the moment?
Yeah, most of the year.
What drove the move to kind of to relocate? You said you kind of touched on earlier about creating your life in a way that feeds the ability to express this vision.
That was pretty obvious once I really landed in Bali. Actually, I went there for the first time in 1999, and that time I was tattooing mainly.
Ah, okay.
And that was what really started to aggravate the repetitive stress in my forearm, was from tattooing for, just, you know, 10 hours a day every day. And it was this thing where I had this, you know, secure financial safety net with tattooing, because I could always do it. I'd always have clients. I'd always be able to take it wherever I wanted. And even though it started to really aggravate my joints and my forearm, it was just like
hard to let go.
Yeah. It was just a, you know, an avenue that could just keep going unless I put a halt to it. And I felt like inevitably that was going to have to happen. But in 1999, I spent a year traveling Southeast Asia, tattooing U.S. sailors, and that ended up ending the journey with a month in Bali. And I first got switched on to Bali from when I was at Beale, at the art school. There was this BBC documentary. I used to watch it. They would air at like 6 a.m. And so I'd get up early to watch these episodes, and it was completely blew my mind that this was going on the planet. It was these two brothers that were funded by Ringo Starr to find the Bird of Paradise in the 70s. Like, not much documentation of these elusive birds in the jungles of Borneo. And so somehow Ringo Starr had a passion for this and gave this funding to these two brothers, Lawrence and Lauren Blair. And so their mission to go do that turned into an almost 10-year-long documentary all throughout the Indonesian islands. And these two planes, they're like flying apart, but I don't know if they just narrowly missed each other. That was interesting. So they traveled all throughout the Indonesian archipelago and documented all these variations of life there that had rarely been seen, or that those cultures had seen anything outside of themselves. And just the most phenomenal footage of being, you know, having like such perilous, life-threatening situations being documented where they're, you know, outrunning tigers or headhunters in the jungle at night and having to hide in trees, or like the pirate tribes on the open seas, like the boogies, we get the word boogeymen from the boogie tribes in Indonesia, were like these ruthless pirates. And so they had encounters with them, and I mean, just crazy. But they ended up landing in Bali and then documenting all these aspects of Balinese life that are so outside the tourist culture, like what they called it, you know, living behind the shadow screen, where it was like what they're multidimensional cosmology is really about. Now it's kind of disguised as Hinduism, but it's really this kind of psychedelic animism. And I mean, just my high school mind was just completely blown open that this is like the other side of the world looks like this, you know. And so I had always I felt such an affinity with that cultural expression, I guess. Mm. And I always knew I would get there eventually. And so when I did this tattoo tour, I wanted to cap it off with Bali. It was actually a really challenging experience when I got there. But the first day that I arrived, I went into Ubud, which is where I'm living now. And I went to this little cafe and I'm sitting in this, there's like a, these kind of pagoda tables out in the rice fields. And sitting next to me is Lawrence Blair, who's like so distinct. He's like 6'7", white, omnidirectionally protruding hair and a black eye patch. You know, it's like
black eye patch.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was like, "What? Are you kidding me? My first day here, and this is who I run into."
Oh.
I was like, "Wow!" I just had to give him so much accolades and appreciation for the influence he had on my teenage imagination and how it influenced me to come there. And
what was his response?
He appreciated my appreciation, but his brother, who was part of these just unbelievably perilous adventures, had just died a month before from falling through a hole in the sidewalk.
Oh my God.
In the city. What is this? Get out of here.
Another helicopter.
Oh, that's the military one. Big guns on it.
They're just documenting the vortex around here.
Yeah, it was just an incredibly, poetic, ironic thing. You know, these guys that just were just the ultimate Indiana Jones characters that just were just skirting the edge of danger constantly and documenting it. And then he just falls through a hole in the sidewalk and gets a blood clot to his brain.
Oh.
And at that time, that was my first time venturing that far out of, you know, the Western world or, you know, familiar culture. And so many people that just are afraid to leave their comfort zones because of, projected dangers. And this guy, like, they just lived it to the absolute extreme. And then that's the way he checks out, you know? So I ended up coming back to Bali in 2004 with a whole team from California, some friends that wanted to make a music video that was intended to be a kind of a collaborative art project between all these friends that all have these mediums and are incredibly skilled in what they do. And so we wanted to join forces in Bali. Yeah, we had this whole vision of what that looked like. And so traveled with these Hollywood film producers and all these people involved. And so I was hired to do all the concept art and making props for the video and doing sketches, making jewelry design, working with wood carvers and tailors and all these people where I could just channel all of my ideas to the people that can manifest them. And that was just so obvious that this is a place that I need to be spending time because it was so accommodating in a way where, you know, I could skip out on winter. I could be in a culture that is just so authentic and friendly. And you know, the cost of living was a lot lower, but it's not exploitative, you know.
Did you feel welcomed?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And it's something that I don't know if I take it for granted, but I kind of forget that the world isn't like this when, you know, you're in Bali and it's like people smile first, you know, and they mean it. And
it's unusual.
Yeah.
So how do you feel now when you go back to like Canada or you come to, does it feel like leaving your little bubble, and does it feel like you're in a bubble, or do you feel connected to the rest of the world when you're
in a way? I mean, there's a lot more friends that are showing up there now and establishing the same kind of, you know, creative
bit of a scene
outlets.
Growing there,
yeah, which has been really nice, but it's also, you know, it means that I'm much more social and much less productive. Whereas before it was like, you know, we had this crew that there's the people that were involved in this music video ended up we all kind of came back year after year because we realized how obvious it was that we needed to be there to be working on our art. And so it was very much about, you know, a purpose being there and getting work done.
Like a which kind is, of ultra supportive environment.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, which is really nice. But now there's so many more people that are coming just for the scene, not for any kind of like purpose or production. Like which is nice too. Mm. Yeah, but it's just requiring extra assertiveness on my part to really stick to what I'm there for and to do my work. Mm. And because I tend to have, you know, 6 to 8 months of the year there with occasional satellite missions to, you know, I'll go to Australia for Rainbow Serpent or, you know, do a show in Japan or, you know, go to, I've had a migration pattern to Goa the last few years. Just take a month off and skip out on the rainy season for a month and go and party. Goa is great, but it's like, it's not a productive place. People aren't really going there to, you know,
yeah, it's got a get purpose, work done. It's like for creativity.
Yeah, and that was good for me too, because I spent so many years just being in this other mode that it's like, oh yeah, I'm also this. I can also just
relax,
hang out on the beach, and go to parties and have fun.
Yeah, yeah. So, where's your are you still doing that kind of working in multiple mediums at the moment? Like, where's your work at the moment? Like, what are you most excited about?
Well, I've got really into digital art for years, and the outcome's really incredible to me, but I'm so much more excited about just original work and painting and so the last several years I've been treating the digital work as a means to an end rather than the end itself.
Oh, okay.
And so planning out and working out all kinds of visual effects and ideas and compositions and things that end up becoming the reference for other work.
Or you kind of then, what you then kind of want to recreate that.
Turn that digital image into a painting, and use the digital image as the reference for the painting.
Yeah,
so
that's
it's
great.
Like,
I like that.
Yeah, so some of the more intensely digitally precise, complex stuff, I'll end up working it out as like a color study in a way, but maintaining a kind of underlying skeletal architecture of the piece, mm-hmm. in the form of like a line drawing or, you know, a kind of base image that I'll end up printing on my own canvas. And I found a place in Bali that can do this. And so, yeah, basically creating a kind of grid or a map that I can paint into and, you know, especially with the symmetrical work. I don't always draw symmetrically very accurately, you know, but when I map it out, then it's basically like I can fill it all in. And
it's so interesting the way these tools have developed and kind of people just respond to them.
Yeah.
And then their process changes and evolves with it. It's fascinating, man. Where do you see it all going? Like, you were talking earlier about VR and that kind of stuff, which is, it's like a whole other world.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily want to immerse myself in developing those tools. I'm kind of wanting to wean myself off of the digital stuff in a way. Even though I love it. It's such a fun process. But I only have so much time in the day, and I want to. Yeah, I don't want to be staring at a screen constantly.
Yeah.
I just finished this last piece that was like such an intense push where I hadn't really been doing digital work like of that intensity for a while, and so I really got into it. And I don't know, I just get so lost in there, like my attending to just linear 3D reality and priorities kind of fall away while I just ride this wave until it crashes on another shore. And it can be a really obsessive state that I get into. Mm. I mean, I get that way with paintings too, or it's just like I can't really go take a break and hang out with friends for the day because all I'm thinking about is the next thing I need to do to that piece, or I'm like, I have to just ride the momentum and not break it. Mm. And
stay in that zone.
Yeah. Mm. But yeah, this last piece that I worked on digitally, I feel like I really neglected my body in a way, because like, I lose myself in the process. I'm not, it's a really bizarre kind of obsessive state that I get into. I mean, my eyes could be totally dried out and getting foggy and fuzzy while I'm working. And all I would need to do is like stop for a second, drink some water, put some Visine in my eyes, look outside. But I don't even do that. I don't even reach to the table next to me. I'm just in that. And I have to just follow it until the wave breaks. Yeah, yeah. I can't break the wave.
Yeah.
It's a really trippy place. And I feel like I, in the past, was maybe more resilient to this, that kind of state. But lately, it's kind of too much for me. Uh-huh. Like I really kind of builds up this kind of pressure inside.
Yeah, it's going to have an effect afterwards, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'm out of energy.
Yeah, I mean, like, expanded. I'll have emails stacking up that I'm just not responding to because I can't even switch my mind to that place. You know? But I really should, if I want to be an accountable, responsible adult, I should actually, like, be on top of things. But once I open this current, it's just the pressure of a fire hose sometimes, and I have to just nimbly surf it until it completes.
Yeah.
And I don't know. That's part of the reason why I live in Bali, too, is that it's... And why I surround myself with the people that I do and create the environment around me that's all kind of catering to this process or this state that I've found myself in. But it's just... It's also integrating a balance, too, that I don't get off kilter with my life when I go there.
Yeah, it's always the learning.
I was feeling like I'm going to need to hire somebody to stand around in a tracksuit with a whistle and a clipboard to make sure that I'm like, okay, that's 3 hours of Photoshop, and now you need to go and like go to the gym, and then when you're done with that, you're gonna get down to your painting and like, you know,
eat lunch. Somebody, remember to eat lunch.
Yeah, eat food and drink water. Like, drink fucking water.
Yeah,
and that's so simple. But it won't even enter my mouth. Even if my mouth is bone dry, I'm like in that just hyper focused. You know, my eyes are cross-eyed as I'm looking at something that's like 6 inches away from my face with a triple zero brush, and my I'm like, mouth is bone dry, and I won't even stop what I'm doing to drink, go to the kitchen, drink water. It's really stupid.
Yeah, that's a crazy process. But then, like you say, you can't do much about that. When it takes over you, it takes over you. But it's yeah, learning how to work with it, work with yourself, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dude, thank you so much for chatting to me today.
Yeah, for sure.
People want to check out and see all these beautiful, remarkable images and creations of yours. Like, where would you send them?
Well, as an artist, I should really have my website fully functional again, which is spectralize.com, spectralees.com, which has been on hold for a while it's being reconfigured. But if you just go to spectralize.com, it'll link to my Instagram, which is @Luke_Brown_spectralize. And that's where all my work and my life updates are all up there right now.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Yeah. Thanks, man. Well, I wish you all the best with it, and enjoy the rest of your time in good old U of K.
Yeah, thanks.
Cool.
I always enjoy myself when I'm here.
Cheers, man.
Yeah, cool, dude.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Just a reminder, if you want to check out some of Luke's work on Instagram, Spectralize, search Luke Brown, Spectral Eyes, all one word, and you can see what he's up to, where he's at, and what his work is currently evolving into. As for me, I'll be back in a couple of weeks with Cole Smith. Much gratitude as ever to the wonderful Ben Chasney of Six Organs of Admittance for our thematic music. And that song is called Light of the Light from his record Asleep on the Floodplain, which you can find on Drag City Records. That's dragcity.com, sixorgans.com. You can find more about us at www.lumierespodcast.com. Life in Fractals on Instagram, Life in Fractals on Facebook. If you want to say hi, do so. If you want to say anything else, please do drop me a line, and take care. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
We found our way. La, la, la.